All right, for the second lecture, we'll essentially do the same thing we did in the previous lecture, except we will now look at operating systems, and we'll attempt to answer the question, first of all, what is an operating system, and why do we want them? This does come from Silberschatz, Glavin, and Gagne. This is Chapter 2. And to answer that question, we're going to take a look at this picture. Actually, I could have simplified this a little bit. So let's get rid of some of this stuff and take a look at a simpler picture. And let's go back. Way back. This is my system. This is my hardware. I have this hardware here. And we know how it executes. We know what the basic execution cycle is. And I want to write a program. For this. This is what I have. I have hardware as well as that little bit of system software we were talking about during the execution sequence, right, the startup sequence. I want to write a program to run on this system. How do I do it? Tell me what I need to do to run a program on this system. You can just outline it so you can give me the general approach. What is the general approach I have to take? And then we can actually go and figure out how to do the implement the general approach. But what's the general idea that I need to do in order to run a program? Don't have any. I have hardware. This is like a Raspberry Pi where we rip the software or Arduinos. Although Arduinos are more controllers than. But this is hardware. I have hardware. I don't have any software. So what do I have to do? Oh, okay, right. Then what good is it? It is, in fact, a paperweight, but it isn't. I mean, you can actually do stuff, and I want to know how to do that. And the question is how. What's the general approach I have to take? And this is like 1950s programming, early 50s. What do I have to do? Okay, so where? So I need to put my program. Let's assume that we're not interested in translation. So I have a set of instructions that represents my program, and I need to put that into primary store. And why do I need to do that? Exactly. I can't execute anything if it's not in primary store. So if I want to run a program, if I want to do anything, it's got to be in primary store. So I put my program into primary store, then what? Okay, and how do I do? That's right. How do I do that? Yes, but how do I get the CPU to do that? That's right, but how do I get the CPU to do that? Right, the fetch, decode, execute cycle. See, now you're corrupted too. but how do I get that started? How did I get it started? I mean, one way to think about this is like, what was that boot sequence we talked about? It's essentially the same thing, right? How do I do that? That's the question. What am I looking for? Sorry? Right. How do I boot the program? Set the PC to the address of the first instruction in my program, and then boom, we're executing. All right, that's it. So if I want to write a program, I have to get into primary store, and then I have to tell the CPU, there it is, go to it. That's it. And then the program will execute. Now the question is, how do I do this? How do I get my program into primary store? This is tricky, but...
In the form of bits.
Yeah, you got to do it with respect to bits, but why is that? Why do I need to do that? And again, the point here, I'm trying to motivate where operating systems came from, as well as to indicate part of their function, which will eventually lead to services. But well, this is actually kind of hard because it's like inconceivable. But generally speaking, what you need to do, well, the way that I used to do it is you would essentially, if you look at the front of your CPU, if you look at the front of your system, you had like 16, depending on how big your word size was, you had like 16 switches. So you would essentially set those switches according to the bits. And then you had another switch, depending upon your system, that said address or data. And depending upon whether you flipped it up to address or down to data, that if you flipped it up to address, those 16 bits would be stored in the program counter. Right? And if you flipped it down to data, then the system, the hardware, would look at the program counter, see what the address is, and store those 16 bits in primary store at that address. Right, so you would step through your program 16 bits by 16 bits, occasionally setting addresses, and then store it into primary store. Then what you would do is you would set the address of the first instruction, hit the switch that says address, and then you'd push the big red button to say go, or big green button to say go. And that's it. That's how you would load your program. All right, everybody got that? I mean, that's the way you do it. Okay. Since there are no questions, my question is, how can we do better? I need to, if these computer things are ever going to get off the ground, we're going to have to do way better in loading my programs. So how can we do this better? That's true. And what would that look like? What kind of steps would I need to take in order to bring that about? Yes, it would, but we need to get there. So we need to figure out what that entails. And starting from this point, I'm starting from this really simple, primitive point of view, what would the first thing, or among the first things, there's a lot of different first things we could look at, among the first things, what would the operating, or let me not say operating system yet, because we're not there. How would I improve this? How would we do better? We have random access, right? Because our representation of primary store is as this array, this indexable array of units. And that's random access. So that comes with the hardware. We don't have to pay for that. Well, we paid for it once, but we don't have to pay for it again. We won't worry about that. We'll assume the bits are there. How we got those bits, we're not concerned. We'll actually mention that briefly towards the end of the lecture, but... You're right, but we're not going to worry about that. This is that's something else. That's the system software. I mean, again, just think about this. How would you do it better? Get rid of the switches, but then how would you replace them with what then? Yeah, you're right. That's what you want to do. You want to get rid of those switches, but replace them with what? Right.
I mean,
All right. Let's do it this way. Let's take a look. So, let's go back. So I'm running my program, and let's assume it's a finite program, so it eventually ends. What does that program do? I mean, I haven't told you, but you can speculate that it does some things. What things does it do? So the program is executing, and eventually it terminates. But before then, what does the program do? Let's assume it's a useful program, too. Not something that you want to turn your paperweight into a space heater. Okay? So you want to do useful things. What does that program have to do? If I tell you it does useful things, then you should be able to conclude some facts about this program, even though you don't know what the program is doing in specific. And in particular... Exactly. It has to take some input and produce output. Right, so it needs to do I.O. Now, you can say, well, you know, maybe you put the data in when you loaded the program, but let's just forget that. So it has to do I.O. How does it do I.O.? How does the program do I.O.? And again, we can just go back to this picture. Right, it has to go through the device controller. So the program itself has to essentially manipulate the device controller. So it has to understand how the device controller works, and then it has to drive the device controller in such a way that it provides I.O. Okay, now you know it's going to do this. It has to do at least output. But, you know, you can also argue maybe not. Maybe the program stops, and then you set the address and look at the bits in primary store. But let's assume that some I.O. happens somewhere. And that's a form of I.O., right? Not a very good one, low bandwidth, but it's still a form of I.O. So the program does I.O. via the controller, and it may do other things. For example, if you are, as they frequently did back in those days, computing ballistics trajectories, then you probably got all kinds of functions. You're computing sines and arc cosines and all this other stuff. All right, so you have these routines that are computing common functions. And then eventually the program ends and produces output. And then what happens? What happens is the next person comes along and runs their program. Right? And what do they do? They do essentially the same thing that we just did. They load the program in through the front panel. They run it. They do some I/O and perhaps compute some common functions. Right. But the point is, they're completely separate from what we've done. They have their sine functions, we have our sine functions. They have their functions to drive the devices to do I/O, we have our functions to drive the devices to do our I/O. And in fact, everybody that uses this system has their own. Okay? So that brings up two problems. All this stuff is at a ridiculously low level. What's the other problem? Redundancy. Everybody's essentially doing the same thing over and over again. All right, so that's what the world is like when you have this hardware and you want to use it in this way. How do we make it? Now we can talk about how we make it better. How do we make it better? We have two problems to attack, and so the question is, how do we do that? What kinds of solutions can we bring to these problems? Well, to answer the first question, what we need to do is we need to raise the level at which we deal with this hardware. Okay, we need to start defining abstractions. We need to define abstractions that enable us to deal with the hardware at a higher level than just a bunch of bits. So we're going to use abstractions to raise the level, which, of course, is standard technique. That's what you do as system developers, as programmers, right? You have a problem to solve. You define abstractions that are relevant to that problem, and then you solve the problem in terms of those abstractions. All right, so that takes care of the first problem, the ridiculously low level. We essentially raise the level at which we deal with the system. Now, that incurs a cost, which we'll take a look at later, but for now, that's how we're going to solve the first problem. What about the second problem? The issue of redundancy. How do we solve that one? How does that get rid of redundancy? Certainly, you can make the redundancy smaller, but that's not getting rid of a redundancy. Well, I run a program, right, and it needs to produce output. Yeah. So I need to write something that drives. Let's assume I want to print the results out. Right, so I need to write something that drives the printer. Okay, so as part of my program, I have a bunch of code that drives the printer to print the output, the results of my program. Okay, now you want to run your program, and you also want to print output. What are you going to do? How are you going to do that? You're going to write your own printer driver. Okay, that's redundancy. I have a printer driver. You have a printer driver. You have a printer driver. So, in fact, we have already solved this problem, redundancy problem. If we have an abstraction, okay, suppose that I say that, well, I'm really tired of dealing with low-level printer driver commands, so I will implement an abstraction of the printer, something that understands, for example, print C. Okay? Once I've done that, I can say to you, well, look, I have this set of code which will allow you to deal with the printer. So you don't have to deal with the printer anymore. Alright? You can just use this code, and then we both have the same code, and we've gotten rid of that level of redundancy. You don't have your code, I don't have my code. We're sharing code. Alright, so by defining abstractions, we can get rid of both the low level, dealing with things at a low level, as well as dealing with the issue of redundancy. Now, that does introduce a cost, which is the second point. We now have to manage those abstractions. Because, for example, you'd have to find out about them. You'd have to know that there is this abstraction for a printer available that you can put in your code so that you don't have to write your own code to deal with the printer. And actually, it gets a little bit more complicated than this, but for now, we'll leave it at that. So with this idea in mind, in particular with the idea of abstractions, let's take a look at this process again and figure out ways in which we could, what kind of abstractions we could implement in order to make this process faster. I've already given you one. So, for example, we need some kind of abstractions to represent the printer. And in the opposite direction, we need some abstractions to be able to handle input, from the keyboard or from a tape reader or wherever. What other kinds of abstractions might we want to have? Excellent. Yes, we need to have some. Now, let's not do that. Let me not do that. Okay, storage, anything else? Somebody mentioned it earlier. What's the central entity that we deal with in this description? In this description as opposed to this description. It turns out the CPU is the right answer, but we need to get there first. Again, that's over here. I'm over here. In this particular description, what is the central entity that we are dealing with?
The program,
exactly. So we need, and I'll just tell you this rather than try and drag it out of you, we need some abstraction, some representation for the program. Now, does anybody know what this is called? Somebody mentioned it earlier. I don't expect you to know this, but process. We have representations for getting things in and out, representations, yes, but in specific abstractions for getting things in and out. We have the thing in the middle, which is the program, and we have our representation for storage. Is there anything else we might want to abstract to improve this process? And the answer, of course, is yeah, lots of things. But with respect to this description, anything else? So the idea is to improve our ability to deal with this kind of system in this way by defining other kinds of abstractions that we can use, something above the level of just the basic hardware. Okay? And to cut to the chase, this is what an operating system does. So this is my point of view of what operating systems are. The book has a slightly different point of view, and other books have other points of view. But I think this is perhaps the most useful way to think about what operating systems do. And essentially, the objective of an operating system, the point of an operating system, is first to define useful abstractions. Okay, and useful means lots of things, but with respect to our discussion up to this point, it essentially means raise the level at which you deal with the system. In other words, raise it from bits to something else, higher level, and provide general facilities, or I guess somebody said generalize the abilities of the system. Right? Same thing. So we'd like to define high-level entities to make it easier to use the system, and then we need to manage those entities. And from one point of view, that's the job of the operating system, is to define these abstractions and then manage them, make them available for people to essentially use to make the system more pleasant. All right, so that's the function of an operating system. But what is an operating system? We know what it does, but what is it? Well, I told you, I gave you a way to think about what it does. But what is it? What is an operating system? It's a program, exactly. An operating system is just another program. Now, it's actually a kind of a special program for reasons that we'll discuss in a couple of minutes. But an operating system is essentially another program that runs on this hardware. And this actually, I don't know, I find this to be an amazing fact. An operating system isn't really anything special. It gets its specialness from the environment within which it runs, but other than that, I mean, it's just code. It's nothing else. It's just another program that you can write. At this point, the book talks about interfaces. I'm going to skip the high-level interface because I don't really care about that stuff. So we'll go to the low-level interfaces and start talking about that. But before we do that, we should probably think about some of the abstractions that an operating system could provide. Again, you might want to think about it in terms of what would make this easier, or you can just rely on your experience. Okay, so what are services? Services are essentially the abstraction plus management. Let's just call it that. Okay, services are abstractions plus management. So what kind of services might we want to develop in order to do this notion of providing an easier environment within which to work? And essentially we can take a look at this example and keep in mind what we had to do. And I will essentially just run down the list to give you the idea of the kinds of abstractions that we want to develop. And then what we'll be doing in the rest of the semester is looking at particular subcategories of those functions and looking at the various abstractions that we can use. So one possibility is user interfaces. And I actually disagree with this, although this is actually a point of contention in operating system design, whether the user interface, in fact, belongs in the operating system. Some people say no, these are like Unix people. That's something that is actually outside the scope of the operating system. On the other hand, you have IBM and Microsoft, who say that it is, in fact, part of the operating system. So I will just mention that, but we are not going to consider it further because I think it's wrong. Very important thing that we were talking about here, program execution, loading and running your program. This abstraction will be taking up the next, I believe, month, the next two sections that we'll be talking about starting on Monday will be related to this issue of loading and running programs. Somebody mentioned device operation. That's another set of abstractions. And this will, I believe, be the third section after processes and concurrency, actually. Somebody mentioned file systems over here someplace. That's another example. This will be the last bunch of lectures. We actually didn't talk about it here, but a file system, you can think of the nature of the abstraction. It's a collection of permanent named data, which, if you think about it, kind of a handy abstraction to have laying around. There are some other ones which we will talk about, but we will not spend a significant amount of time. In other words, there is not a section for this. One is communication, both within the system, intra-system communication between processes, and communication inter-system, between systems, okay, which is essentially networking. I'm not really going to say that much about networking. You can take the networking course if you'd like to do that. Error detection and prevention is an important aspect of all parts of the abstractions that is part of the management. We'll talk about that when we talk about multi-programming systems. So in that sense, it gets folded into all the other sections that we'll be talking about. Resource allocation, very important. I think I mentioned this earlier in the previous lecture, that one way to think about, another way to think about operating systems, I think about them in terms of abstractions and management. Another way to think about them is in terms of scheduling. Operating systems are just big schedulers, right? Which is true. That's what they are. That's an important part of them. But I usually think of them more in terms of the abstractions they define and the way in which they manage those abstractions, which include, in part, scheduling. Accounting, who cares? Protection and security, again, something that is threads throughout all the other sections. In the fall, I actually had a section on security and protection, but we don't have the time to do that because of spring break, so I threw that away. On the other hand, it will be something that's threaded through, much like error detection and prevention, so we will actually talk about that, but we won't do it in a formal section. That's about it. But these are the ones that we are going to be spending most of, except for the user interface stuff. These are the ones that we're going to be spending our time on. What are we missing? Oh, very important one. Anybody want to guess? What's the piece that we don't have there that we have here? Storage management. That's the other main section that we'll be talking about. Okay, so that's what essentially an operating system is. It's a big program that defines these really useful abstractions and then makes them available to anyone who wants to use the system. And what we'll be looking at is the various kinds of abstractions that you can implement and how you would implement them. And that's what an operating system is. Any questions? All right, since we are gallivanting off to operating systems and we're raising the level of things, we don't need this anymore, so let's just get rid of it. Now, in order to do this, in order to define these abstractions, particularly, for example, those related to the notion of processes or loading and running programs, there needs to be support. For example, you need to figure out where the bits came from. That is usually not the job of the operating system. That's the job of things like compilers, linkers, and loaders. Oh, actually, there's something missing here, and we're not going to talk about it at all, but I'll just mention it here. What does anybody recognize something else that should be here that isn't? It's sort of related to the issue associated with management. Performance. How well are the abstractions being managed? Okay. This turns out to be an important aspect of dealing with the system as a whole. It's something that we're not going to talk too much about. I don't know if there is a course in performance. I know there is at the graduate level, but I don't know if there's a course in performance, system performance, I don't know, maybe in software engineering. But we're not going to spend very much time talking about that at all. It will come up from time to time, though, so I'll mention that briefly. Okay, these things come under the heading of system programs. They are not part of the operating system proper, but they do have pretty interesting links between the individual programs and the operating system. It's actually pretty fascinating, the relationship between these two, but unfortunately we don't have any time at all to talk about these things, so we're not going to. I just mentioned them to indicate that these are sort of outside the scope of this course, which is unfortunate, but there it is. And it did, in fact, come up a couple times. Some people mentioned it. All right, so that's it for system programs. Let us talk about, let's go back to operation in the system. No, let me skip that. Let me just go straight to operating system design and implementation. So we are essentially going to now answer the question, what does something that does this, in terms of this, look like? We already said that it's a program. And the question now we want to answer is, what does that program look like in a general sense? And there's a number of different ways in which you can implement an operating system or essentially provide its structure. And the simplest one, the one that's most common, is what's known as the monolithic, which is one big block of code. Now, this has the advantage of being very efficient in the sense that there are no barriers in between the components of the operating system. Right? So it's essentially cost-free to access any part of the operating system from any other part of the operating system, which is good because the operating system is involved in everything, so it needs to be efficient. What is the disadvantage of a monolithic, structureless, more or less, operating system? Just in general. In what sense? Why is that a problem? Right. So, okay. But let's see. I'm trying to wrestle that into a form that's more general. So you're right. It is a question of security. But the reason it is a problem is because there are no boundaries.
Yeah.
Right. So the on the positive side, it's efficient. But on the negative side, there's no protection. Right. And operating systems are very complicated programs, so the fact that you have a monolithic structure in a complicated program means you have essentially no control over complexity. Now, of course, in the fight between control over complexity and efficiency, efficiency always wins, but that's unfortunate. The next structure that you can apply to an operating system is a layered structure. And essentially, this is, as the name suggests, a sequence of layers where each one of these layers represents an abstract machine. Alright, so we start down here with the hardware, bless you. We start down here with the hardware, and then we implement a stack of abstract machines. The point here is that each machine provides abstractions to the next higher machine. So what you do is you gradually build up a sequence of abstract machines until you get to the top when you have the complete operating system. Okay, this turns out to be an extremely nice way to implement an operating system, and this is an approach that was developed by a number of people, but it was popularized by Dijkstra back in the 60s, and he has a very nice paper called The Structure of the THE Operating System, which I highly recommend if you're interested in operating systems design or just design of complex systems in general to read. It's not that difficult. It's about 5 or 6 pages. Okay, so the advantage of this is essentially it is the reverse. So now we have control over complexity because we get to define what each one of these abstract machines do. Right, and because we can essentially create a sequence of them, they can be very simple. And just by stacking one on top of the other, we can eventually reach our goal of providing the full set of services that we've listed over there. What's the cost?
Efficiency.
Right, exactly. And why is it inefficient? There's actually a lot of answers to that, but why is this structure inefficient? Well, if you take a look at it, what you see is there are a lot of boundaries here. Right? And one of the things that we'll learn in this class is that whenever you have a boundary, it costs you a lot to go across. Right? So if you have like 7 or 8 layers, which I believe is what the THE operating system had, then it's going to be quite expensive to go from the hardware up to the programs that are running back down to the hardware. Okay. There are other problems involved, such as the ability to get low-level access for efficiency, but it's essentially along the same line. So this is an excellent way to control the complexity of the system, but it's very costly in terms of essentially providing the access. But this is a very nice approach to take. Next approach is microkernels, and it's sort of like this. Sort of like the layered approach, except that you only have one layer, and that layer is known as the microkernel. So you have a single layer, and in a sense, this represents the basic operating system. This is sort of the smallest set of abstractions that you can define to provide access to the hardware. All right, so this is the minimal set of abstractions. Everything else is done outside the microkernel. So what you have in general are a bunch of servers. Okay, and they interact with the microkernel. So in a sense, you have a sort of a primary operating system, and then you have a secondary operating system, which represents the collection of servers. And then outside of that, you have the actual programs that we are running. Alright, so you can begin again to see the problems here. We have boundaries, so that means it's going to be expensive, and this has been one of the knocks against the microkernel architecture, is that it's too expensive. On the other hand, it's extremely flexible, because these servers don't have to be protected like the microkernel does. Right, so you can write, as a programmer, your own set of servers and make them available, and in fact, people do. So this provides for great flexibility. It also reduces the complexity because the microkernel is minimal. It reduces the complexity of the operating system, which makes it easier to argue that your operating system is correct, which is something we're not even going to consider in this class. The last structure we will look at is the one that obtains in most modern operating systems, and that's a modular structure. So I've told you what's wrong with the microkernels. How do we fix that problem? We like this structure, right? This idea that we have a sort of a hard kernel function that we can use to implement other functions that act as sort of secondary operating systems. But it's too expensive because we have these layers that we have to cross. How do we fix that? We want to make it better. How do we do that? Okay. And how would you suggest we do that? No idea? Well, okay. Well, that's right. We want to get rid of those layers because that's where the cost is. How do we do that? Right, but since you said outside, that means we still have boundaries. So how do we get rid of those boundaries? That's it. Have it inside. So what we do is we take the microkernel and we stretch it and bring these external servers inside. We bring them inside as modules. So the modular structure is we have our operating system here, and then we have the microkernel, and then we have a bunch of modules, right, that are inside the microkernel, which is now just a kernel. So now we have the efficiency of the ability to access these individual services, and we're not crossing layers. Okay, but what have we lost? No, we have efficiency, but what have we lost? That's not clear, but we have lost something that is clear. We lost the ability to essentially add new services, right? Because if you're going to put something in the operating system, you just can't put any old code. Because, again, you have to do, because it is inside, you do have to worry about security and protection and things like that. So we've lost the flexibility of implementing all these services outside the microkernel, but we gain the efficiency that you can get when you have everything on the same side of a layer. So you have efficient access. And this is pretty much, like I said, this is what Linux does. There is no division into modules here. Right? It's essentially just bunches of code. There's no organized approach to doing this in a monolithic kernel. It's just a bunch of, it's a big block of code, essentially. Here, you have a structure. You can go to the Linux, for example, device driver interface and figure out what the interface between these device driver modules, for example, and the rest of the operating system kernel is. Right? And you should follow those. And then there are other operating systems, for example, the Spring operating system and other more modern operating systems that give you even greater function here. And there are, in fact, some operating systems that will let programs download code into the kernel. Okay. And, in fact, this is actually an interesting question as to what kind of code belongs in here. But we are pretty much out of time. So let me see if there's anything else I wanted to talk about. This is section 2.7 we just talked about. The rest of the chapter has other things like different kinds of architectures, parallel, multiprocessor, things like that. We will not consider those because we're not going to look at them. That's it. Are there any questions? If there are no questions, we're done.